This is Fam Electric Ghost, and we're with Tabitha Thoreau, a generational growth. You're into that's one of the topics we're talking about, generational growth and unveiling legacy wealth. Blueprint is the focus today. I wanted to welcome to the podcast. How are you doing tonight?
I'm fantastic. Thank you so much for having me.
Want to let people know that we are a featured podcast on the Newsly Network. You can check that out using the coupon code GHOST and check that. It's a live-only audio version of the podcast that you'll get, and that if you use coupon code GHOST, you can check that out. We also have your URL, keeplegacywealth.com, there, and that will be fully clickable on all the platforms we're on. We're on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitch right now. And one of the first things we ever ask a guest, the first two things we ask is, what motivates you and why do you do what you do?
Oh, that's such a loaded question. You know, I've always had a deep desire to help people succeed, bring out the best potential out of people. I had a mom who had an autoimmune disease, so she suffered a lot growing up. And so I feel like that's a deep seed for me to help get people out of suffering. I also have a deep desire to see families unite and find joy and connection and live generations of prosperity and abundance. And that's been something that has always been instilled in me. But recently, I've myself broken chains of scarcity and lack mindset. And I really have a desire to help break that for other families.
That's a good thing to do, because there's certain people in society haven't had the advantage of generational legacy. A lot of times, you know, a lot of Americans live paycheck to paycheck. They don't have an example from their parents or their grandparents of any kind of wealth building. Yes. So it's good to see how you go about doing it if people don't have that history.
Yeah. So first things first, like I always tell people, evaluate where you are. So like looking at money, what does that mean to you? Okay. So money brings a lot of emotion to different people, different ways. So a lot of money for people that it can think like, you know, money's the root of all evil, or money doesn't grow on trees, or they associate money being taken from them, or I can't release money. Like they look at money as like, oh my gosh, I'm always giving. I'm always throwing money away. You know, the language that we use around money is really a testament of how we feel about money. And growing up, money was always scarce. So there was a lot of emotion for me around money. And I'm sure your audience, like, think about like how your parents viewed money and wealth and the words that they used for that. So I say this because how we view money is a testament of how we will view it in the future. So if you think money is the root of all evil, then that means that your heart is evil. Like if you were going to be given $1 million, if you're evil, you're going to do evil things with it. If you're a kind and generous person, you're going to do kind and generous things with it. My goal is to help people release it and look at money like a tool, like fun, like it's ebbs and flows. When you release it into the atmosphere, it will come to you in ways that, you know, when you have good work ethic and when you do the things, not just sitting on your couch eating Cheetos, trying to manifest money. That's not what I'm saying. You can't just, you know, have a magic genie and say, oh, I want $1 million. But when you go into the world and say, how can I serve the world the best of my abilities, whatever that is for you. If you're a plumber, you're the best plumber on the market. If you're, you know, an author writing the best book, whatever that looks like for you, it doesn't matter. And releasing it and look at it in an abundance mindset, it will come back to you. And so we're looking at that as a tool rather than this thing that I have to hoard that's going to be scarce, that's going to be taken away from me. Or if I give it, like if I give it, then I'm not going to get it because I'm not going to have it. So when you're talking wealth, you want to look at money as a way to invest in things that are going to make you like little money babies is what the way I look at it. I use language and terms that are not normal in the financial world. So, you know, buckle up, because I think that that can be boring. Financial literacy, when you hear that word, I want to take a nap. And most people, their eyes glaze over. And so I want to teach people, hey, how can we use our money for us? so we can release it and it can work for us. Okay. And you can do it in all different ways, but the oldest way, the best way, the simplest way is to invest in real estate. It's proven over the test of time. When you look at it as a long game, it is something that's going to withstand a lot of the turbulence that most investing, you know, where that happens, because yeah. you're going to have that. Right. So looking at that's that as like how I can invest in that.
Because a lot of people have been burned by the stock market or burned by, you know, Bitcoin. And so, you know, a lot of traditional financial advisors, they, you know, it's like, it seems more like the lottery. It seems like, right. like, or you have to have like a mathematics background to understand or be yeah. really connected to figure out yes. what the trends are. And it's like, well, not everybody's into economics 301. And so how can right. you figure it out? And right. so, yeah, like the bottom line is like what I've seen, you know, as a creative person is a lot mm-hmm. of my friends, you know, are into real estate. Like they have yeah. apartments or condos they rent, and that brings an income and it seems stable. It seems more stable than the other things I just mentioned. And yep. so that's something that some people may not know how to get into that. So maybe you can talk about real estate investing. Like how did you get into it and what do you teach about it?
Yeah. So I was blessed to have gotten into it when I was 19. And that was because my husband, he was 21 at the time. His dad had started investing in real estate about 6 years prior to that. And so my husband saw his dad investing in real estate and as rental properties. And he thought, man, when I'm in college, like I might as well have someone pay my rent for me. So he bought a house. I helped him renovate it, help, you know, get the tenant situation, that kind of property manage it. So he lived in the basement, he had tenants upstairs and he was like, okay, let's do this. And within the next year, he had another house, did the same thing, except he didn't live in it. He just rented it out. So we got started early because my husband by trade is a farmer. And he has a construction contracting background. So he knew he was not going to have a boss that was going to have a retirement plan for him. And he thought, if I want to build anything and retire at whatever age I want, I have to do this. And so we saw that early. Now, fast forward, if somebody came to us today and said, hey, you know, we'd never invested in real estate, what would we do? It's the same. It would be the same strategy because a single family home is the easiest port of entry for real estate. You'll see a lot of people right now like, do this Airbnb. I didn't even own the Airbnb and I'm making $2,700 a month, or, you know, just put money in and we'll do the apartment building syndication. You know, you have all these fast track ways. And I'm not saying that they don't work because I know that they do. But I do know that if you're the first time income property owner, especially if you don't even own your own home yet, but even if you own your own home and you want to like have an income property, we really want something simple. And a single family property is simple because you can even do like a 2-bedroom, 3-bedroom, 4-bedroom. Well, that's, you're dealing with, you know, 2, 3, 4 people rather than an Airbnb. You're dealing with could be up to 52 people or more, right? Yeah.
Yeah. It's very frequent. And then you have maybe their turnover. And the risk in that turnover.
And problems.
Is that what the issue is? Like the risk in the turnover because it's so much turnover.
Right. Because like Airbnb, you just look at people. Like all business is people, right? So like if you're going to deal with people, real estate's no different. So like when I assess it, I'm like, okay, if I just have to deal with 4 tenants rather than a potential of like 52 tenants, what do you think the ratio is of problems there? Right. And the more you have people coming in and out of Airbnb,
it's less problems with less people.
Exactly. And then when you have people coming in and out, damages, you know, when people are on vacation and things like that, stuff isn't taken care of.
You
know,
a lot of
maintenance. And you can build a team to where it can be really passive. But if you've never done it, why would you choose the hardest race? You know, if you've never ran a race before, would you go sign up for a marathon? No, you'd probably do like the couch to 5K or maybe even a 2 mile or a walk run situation, right? So this is kind of the walk run. Like you go into a single family home, you look at the area. I have a free resource at my website. You can click on that. It's like the 5 things to look for when you're buying that first property. But you go into it with the mindset of, why am I buying this property? Because that is important. And sometimes as entrepreneurs and business owners, you know, we're like, we just want to make money. We just want to make money. Well, it has to be deeper than that. It has to be, you're building something that's going to stand the test of time that you can pass on to your kids. Now, I'm not saying you're going to have that house forever. You might sell it and buy a bigger property or do something later on, but you're building something that's bigger than just that income right now. And so you have to look at the why.
You were saying, but a question I had, like you're talking about a single family home being converted into apartments or just allowing people to have like roommates. Is that what's just the simplest roommates. Thing to do?
Don't worry about it.
It's not converted.
Don't worry about converting anything. Again, like we're simple. So you buy this home, it's a 3-bedroom. You have somebody, we recommend looking at the area and going where there's like a college close by or even like a hospital where, you know, nurses and doctors are coming in residency and they'll have roommates. Okay. Like everybody like that has roommates. And so you're going to have that where you just a regular house with 3 roommates, make it easy peasy. You don't have to worry about like zoning or, you know, building out extra entrances or anything like that. You just have that.
That's another question. Like if you buy a home that's in a homeowners association, would they not allow that subletting? Do you have to make sure you're in a place that allows like the subletting or rental?
So, So anything with like homeowners association, you just have to ask them. A lot of areas in those neighborhoods probably won't allow like tenant situation. I mean, again, you just have to know those kind of rules and you have to know the zoning, like how many relative people can live in a house because that's something to look for. Most places it's about 4, but you know, again, that those are city codes that you just literally make a phone call and it's quick, easy, and you can do that. I would recommend not getting a house in a homeowners organization because you're going to have extra fees and that's going to cut into your cash flow. So again, for your first time,
more rules, and there's rules.
Yeah, more rules. Yeah, more rules, more fees, everything. Yeah. Again, we want path of least resistance for your first one. Like later on, if you can get in a house that's like that and you could raise the rent would justify it. Like you could, you know, double the rent because the area is so nice and you could get. Yes. That's again.
Maybe it's like college professors, like you said,
doctors,
be, like not cause trouble.
And traveling doctors.
People
and
who aren't going to be a risky tenant. You don't want like a risky, you want to be risk averse with your tenant, a tenant that's not going to not be able to pay the rent.
It's going to be, and again, that's another beat.
And
that's another level.
In terms of like the process, like,
Like, so I would just say that,
like, or do you use your own checkout of people or do you go with a service?
Yes. So that's another thing. Like when you first get started, again, you have to look at the numbers. I always tell people it's all about the numbers. When my husband and I first started, we did everything. We property managed, we fixed everything. We were there. We did it. Because we wanted cash flow and we didn't have good mentors that taught us our time is valuable. We just were like, no, we have to save money. Now, if you can allow it. Just do DIY. We are just the DIYers and we did that for years and years and years. But if you can hire a property management company from the beginning and still be cash flow positive, I highly recommend that because it's going to allow you the freedom to buy house number 2, 3, 4, 5. When you're tied up in that first house and you feel like you're constantly fixing stuff or tenants are calling you or, you know, you're new at it. So you know, you're doing all the things. It's hard to look at that on a scale, but when you have a property manager come in and they deal with filling the tenants, dealing with complaints, just checking in with you every once in a while, it really eases you up. First of all, to have time freedom with your family, to work on your business, to buy more properties, all of those things. And really, if you've ran the numbers correctly, you have room in your budget for it. And that's the thing. It's like getting that house to be cash flow positive, running those numbers and looking at that in advance. So you don't get the house and then you're like, oh no, I have no room. No, we want you to have room in the beginning so that you can have that time freedom. We don't want you to be a slave to the house. We want this to be, you know, to give you time with your family and also bring the family in, like have them help you like look for the house, do open houses, bring your kids in, bring whoever, like make them a part of the journey so that when you are taken away from the family for that property, for whatever reason, they understand it and they don't look at it like, oh, that's a negative thing. They're like, no, this is a positive thing. Mom or dad are doing this for us to build our wealth. And that's the second part of our program that we talk about.
So a question I had on like if you own the house, I assume that you would typically have your own homeowner's insurance. Or did each renter have their own insurance for like an apartment? How does that work?
So you hold homeowner's insurance and you pay the taxes. Again, that's in the numbers. So you calculate that. But we recommend for tenants to have tenant insurance because if there's a flood and it ruins all their stuff, they're liable, not us. But if they have tenant insurance, that's covered in that. And that's something that a lot of tenants don't understand. They think, oh, if there's a flood, then you have to pay for this. And you don't. Unless there's something in your state that, you know, I'm not aware of. Because I don't know all the state laws. So check it out. But from my understanding, it's pretty universal. Like you as a tenant need to cover, or like a fire or something like that. My insurance will cover the house and all those things, but the stuff inside, that's the tenants, they are liable for that. So that is important. But yes, I pay insurance, I pay taxes on it. And that's what you figure out before you even charge for your rent, to figure out what that is, to know what your ROI is.
I guess another question, when you're buying properties, like you get an older house, it's like, you don't want a house that needs a roof in the next year, right? Because then you got to get a brand new roof. You maybe don't want a house that needs a brand new furnace or a brand new central air conditioner. So how do you make those assessments that you don't get like a stinker? Like you get a house, you get it, and then the roof goes bad. And then the furnace goes bad and the water heater goes bad. Then your cost of what you assess to be the rent might not match what your costs actually are to maintain the house.
Yes. So when we're looking at a house, there's a couple different lenses, right? Like if you look at an old house and you think instantly like, I don't want to deal with that. And that's your mindset. You're like, nope, I don't even want to deal with that lemon. I'm not going to do it. That's okay. But just know that another house that's more in pristine condition, the price is going to go up. So when my husband and I are looking at a house, we look at something like we call lipstick on a pig. Like what can we just jazz up a little bit? But from the outside, it might scare people from buying because they don't want to necessarily do it. But we have the skill set and the knowledge to do that. And now we have connections and contractors that come in and do that. When you're first looking at a house, again, you have to look at the numbers. So we'll look at a house and honestly, we'll get it in contract before we have it inspected. Because if it's inspected and then something like that happens, like it needs a new roof, it needs a new water heater, anything like that, we can do one of two things. We can negotiate the price with the seller, and usually they're willing to do it because they have a buyer on the hook. Okay. Or I'm like, I'm out. Like, that's too much. You need a roof. You need this. Oh my gosh, we're looking at $40,000, $50,000. If they're not even willing to budge on price, like I'm out. Like, and you can get out of the contract and go to the next one. So there's always a next property. So when you look at that, stuff like that is disclosed and you have an inspector. I mean, I always tell people pay the inspector, whatever that costs, even if it's $800, $1,000, whatever it is for your inspector in your area, because they will be able to tell you. Yeah. And they'll be able to tell you like this, the water heater, it looks good, but oh my gosh, look at this line, you know, whatever. Now I'm fortunate that my husband knows a lot about houses, so he can go through a house, but we still, even with his knowledge, will get an inspector. Because again, like you said, if you need a roof, that's 40K easy, depending on where, you know, where you're at, what you're doing. It could be more, could be less, but you don't want to get that and then be like, oh my gosh. But here's the thing. I'm going to give some people hope on the other side, because this always scares people. And I'm about getting people to make that leap and not live in fear. If that happens to you, guess what? There is money out there for you to replace that, and you can fix it, and you can find the money and find the lenders to help you fix that and not be like feeling like you have to steal from your kid's college fund or sell an organ or whatever. There's money out there that will do it, like a hard money loan. Like there's just so many different things that you can do to get the money for that. And now even with government, like I'm not one to like borrow from the government, but there's even government grants and things like that, that you can outsource if stuff like that happens. So don't be scared of that as like, oh my gosh, I don't know. And what if the contractor says it's okay and then it's not? And you know, there's a lot of legal loopholes that you can get out of a property, but if you do have it and it's yours and like a month later, something happens that's big, don't think, oh my gosh, what did I do? Think of, oh my gosh, where's the solution? Like, where is the money that I need to get this? Because it's there. I promise you that. Like, it's there. It's just from what I said earlier, we have so many money blocks and we're so afraid of money being the thing that holds us back that we don't move forward. So there's definitely ways around that. But be smart. Like, when you go to a house, like, get it inspected, look at it. Look at all angles of it. Does it already have tenants in it? You know, is this a property that someone's trying to get rid of because, you know, they're downsizing or whatever? Do they already have tenants in it? Because when you go to a bank and it's already an income producing property, that's going to make your stature with the bank look a lot more appealing.
Better. I was wondering about that. Cause like, if you haven't had any experience with, tenants, and then like, well, how do I make sure I don't get lemon tenants? Like, how do I make sure, like, I got this, but like, I need the tenants to pay the mortgage on this place. And I don't have a good choice. I don't know how to do that correctly.
Yep.
Then I could totally deep six the whole thing. So what was your experience in being able to do that?
So I don't think anybody will go through what we went through through COVID, because as landlords during COVID was probably the hardest time that landlords have ever seen, because so you guys don't have to go through what we already went through. Okay. You're going to learn from our lessons here. And we were fortunate. I mean, we had most of our tenants did pay, or they were back paid. A lot of them were back paid. Like they missed months and stuff like that, but we had built a structure that could withstand that. Right. So that's why when I tell people, we don't want to just help you buy one property, we want to help you buy 10, because it's like the boat, right? Like, you don't want a little dinghy, like you want a yacht that's going to withstand a storm. Right. But it's baby steps. You got to start somewhere.
Yeah, so if you're down there, you don't have enough.
Yeah.
It's like a weak structure.
Yeah. Right? If you have
there, you can barely afford the first property. You don't have enough people in it, then you're going to have, like, if anybody stops paying rent in that one property, you're like down.
Right. And that's why, like, looking at it from the beginning, my husband, like, he bought two properties, I think, within a year of each other, because it was like, okay, we can do this, because you borrow Peter to pay Paul and, you know, do different things like that. And once you buy one property and you work with the same bank, it's actually easier to buy a second property because you can leverage, which is awesome. So it's just getting that first property, because then you have money to work with to leverage to get more money, which is awesome. But that's later on if you want. But with the tenant question, if you have a property management company, they do it for you and it's amazing. But if you start out and you're like, no, I want to do it all myself first before I hire someone, which I think is noble, like, you can do that so you know the process. Honestly, if they have a job, you call their employer and say, how long have they been working here? Do you see them working here for the next 6 months? They'll tell you. I mean, I've never really asked income disclosures over the phone for jobs. They put it there. I usually know if it's a waitressing job or a management job, you gauge that. Legally, I've just never asked to disclose that information, but I'm sure, I don't know if you could, it depends on where you're state you're at. But if they're a manager at, you know, a dealership, car dealership, or a manager at like a, even a government job, and they've worked there for 2 years, there's a good chance that they're going to continue to work there. Right. And if they're in good standing with the job, that's all you can really go on. Now, if they're going to put in there, I mean, we've had tenants that are like, well, I'm in between jobs right now. I'm not going to rent to them. Like, they don't have income. And so looking at their income, and then past landlords, you call their landlord and say, would you rent to them again? Did they pay on time? Did they pay the full amount? How did they leave the place? Those are questions that by law you can ask, you know, like, were they a good tenant? Would you rent to them again? And if they're like, no, they were horrible, they left big holes in the wall, or, you know, whatever, they're probably going to do the same thing to mine. But if they left it in good condition, I'm going to trust that they're going to leave it in good condition again. So a little bit of a trust and just calling those references, calling those people and saying, hey, do they have employment? And then how were they a tenant in the last one? Sometimes we have people that were never a tenant. Like, they came out of the dorms from college. And so I look at their job and I say, okay, I look at their job, and then their parents, I'll contact their parents sometimes and say, if they're unable to pay, what's that look like? You know, like, you have to cover your bases a little bit and stuff. We do a lot of with referrals now, and that works like a gem, because if I had a good tenant refer somebody else, 9 times out of 10, the person they refer is good too. You know, because like-minded people. So that helps. Mm-hmm. But if you have a property management company, they do all this for you. So you don't even have to worry about it.
Well, they do. Like, the question I had is, like, typically, would you be able to get like a credit report? I know, like, if you go to an apartment building and it's like one of these managed apartment buildings, they ask the tenants for their credit reports. Yep. If you're somebody that's doing this on your own, can you get that, or you can't get that?
You can, but I think it's a fee. And honestly, I don't really care what their credit report is. I mean, they could have horrible credit, but be coming out of that and have a good paying job now, and they could have been a stellar tenant. And, you know, it's about where they are now, because they're not paying me through credit.
More to you.
You know, I don't take credit cards.
I guess it's if they're just seeing if they're not paying things. Yeah, I just don't. No. I know that the big apartment buildings look at it to see, like, if they're a problem credit.
Right. And it's behavior.
Behavior.
It's a behavior thing.
They might miss paying rent.
Yep. And also, a lot of ours are open houses, and I'm there. And so I see people. And so I've done this enough. I've dealt with hundreds and hundreds of tenants to where I'm looking at that. The first time homebuyer, again, I would just say, look at your referrals, like the tenant, the landlords that they've had before, look at their employer, and you can even call like a character reference. But here's the thing about character references. They're always going to put someone that's going to tell them they're great. They're never going to put someone on there that says, oh, Johnny's horrible. I don't know why you put me on there. You know? But so that's why the landlord, landlord, call the ex-landlord and the employer. And honestly, that's all you really need. Make it simple.
That's interesting. So this whole process, what it seems like a train, like you got, once you get going with one property and you expand to two, then it becomes like exponential.
Yeah.
And then that seems like you're saying that if you could get a management company, the more properties you have, it seems like, unless that's going to be your full-time job and you want to be doing the maintenance, you want to be handling the complaints, you want to be doing all that stuff. Is that like, do some people want this to be their job, or they want it just to be a second source of income or third, you know, wealth builder without that involvement?
Right. So there are people that want to do real estate as a business. They're like, I want to do this. And they still will hire out property managers because they want, if they're smart, and like I said, we did this wrong for a long time. If they're smart, they'll hire out a property manager because they always want to find the next property and build that, their empire that way. Okay. We target people who are entrepreneurs, business owners, that in the beginning, anyway, they don't want another job. They love their job. They love whatever they're doing, but they know, like, okay, I'm earning income right now. income and wealth are two different machines. And so unless you have one machine kind of going on its own, you're always going to have to fuel that machine. So if you can automate it as much as you can with a property manager, with lawn care, with, you know, everything, the bills being paid. And a lot of times your property manager will take care of all of those things, but making sure all of that is like a well-oiled machine. And then like even your CPA knowing you have these properties for wealth building, because part of wealth building is tax strategy. You have, and that's why people do real estate. Yeah, because those are tax breaks and that's smart. And so you want to make sure all of those pieces are, but our target audience are entrepreneurs and business owners with families. So they have family, they have their business, maybe they have a hobby. They don't want this to be like another thing, but they know if they don't, what's going to happen? Too much time.
Yeah. Being a plumber. Right. You don't want to be a plumber and an electrician if you're not really the plumber. Or the electrician.
No.
Because your tenants aren't going to like you either.
And you're not going to like you.
But no, you probably don't want to do that. But the question I had about like once you get that process going, right, you have, are there advantages to buying certain types of properties for tax benefits? Like if you go into like an area in a city, does the city have like programs where they'll give the people who get to go into that neighborhood to kind of rehabilitate it, would they give you like a break? Are there things like that you can look into where you like recommend that maybe you should do that because you're going to have a better tax outcome?
Yes. So if you're looking for tax strategy and you're kind of looking at this a little more business, like, okay, I kind of want real estate a little bit, you know, I can do a side hustle business, because again, then you're going into another business. And so just people realize that like that, this takes effort, right? Like this takes discipline, but there's areas, especially like inner city or like in our state, I live in Nebraska. So out west, there's not a lot of homes. It's a lot of pasture ground, farm ground. And so there's different tax breaks where if you build up businesses, like bricks and mortar businesses and houses, or like in inner cities, areas that are really run down, if you go in and you put a property that it will be a rental property that will help and you will renovate that home and make it look nicer, there are definitely incentives. I think there's even, I know there's money out there. Again, there's always money, like money out there to help you renovate and get these going, but also the tax breaks. Yes. Yes. And like even in countries, because like Puerto Rico, a lot of Americans are moving there because there's no capital gains tax there, because they're trying to get people to move there and renovate the country, because since the hurricanes, it's still pretty run down. And so there's tax. So looking at your state. And want to do it. So looking at that as like, I know there's area, I know inner city one and like area remote areas. I think maybe Wyoming has some of the remote areas, maybe Montana, different states in that area. And I know even businesses, like if you're a bricks and mortar and you want to expand your business, like look at those areas because there's tax breaks for those areas as well. So you can kind of double dip. That's what's really fun. When you get a business that you can renovate, I'll go on a side note here. Like when you expand and do commercial and you can put a business in a commercial building and sell the, and then you sell the business and you can still charge them rent. If you do a franchise, you can double dip and charge a franchise fee and the rental fee. And then that gets really kind of fun. So the real estate stuff is fun. Like the money part of it's fun when you get down the road a little bit, you know, but so many people don't take that first step. And that's what we want to help them with. Take that first step. Buy that first income property.
It sounds interesting because you just mentioned there, it seems like a third, fourth step. And like if you started to build a little empire of a lot of houses and then you've got them all managed. And then you say, hey, why not do commercial? Why don't I go look at the downtown? I live in New Hampshire and there's a downtown. And, you know, can I get some of these downtown fronts and actually set them up and get businesses in there? Or even on in a lot of these in the old New England downtowns, there's a business on the first floor and there's apartments on the other floors. And a lot of times those apartments aren't really being used, or nobody's using that space at all.
Yep. And that's what they're doing with like Airbnbs, is doing like a commercial place as a business. And then the apartments upstairs are Airbnbs because people want to be close to downtown when they're like traveling, that, you know, like the nightlife or whatever. So then they're using those for Airbnb. And again, those are great. That's not where we want people to start, because it's a whole nother thing. Like my husband and I, we are getting into storage units. And again, storage units are great. It's another beast. It's a whole nother thing. And we're actually building them out. Like we bought land and we're building them out. So I'm never going to have someone who just first instinct like comes into that. Let's start here. And then you can always build it. And then you go to that. Now, if you're business minded and you have a team and you're like, you want to jump in, by all means, like do that. But there's a lot of other hoops that you have to go through. Like with us, with the land, you have to make sure that the land is not by like too close to a railroad, or like the land isn't contaminated by stuff that's been there before. You know, all those things that we have to go through.
Yeah.
And delaying it, where a single family home, I could literally walk through in this hour and I could have been under contract by the end of this hour. Like that's how fast you can do it. Especially once you've been going and you have relationships with banks. Like I went to our banker and I said, we want to double our properties in 3 years. And he said, go, like, we'll finance you, like, go find the properties, bring them to us. Like he knows that we will bring them income. So he's not scared to loan us out the money because we built that relationship.
Mm-hmm. So it's about that trust. You build that relationship. And you're saying a lot of people are scared to make the first step. So how do you get people to get around the fear of that first step? Because they're like, they got this thing in their head saying, well, that's too risky. That's too much. They're thinking it's like the stock market. They're going to like, oh, it's like going to Vegas and I'm going to hit the wrong thing. I'm going to lose it all. So there's like, how do you get people to like not think that it's that?
Well, that's why we created the group, the community that we're in, because it really is who you surround yourself with. Because if you go to your family reunion and everybody in your family legacy is broke, or, you know, they've never invested in real estate, they live paycheck to paycheck, you know, life's, you know, lay life. And maybe they're great people. I'm not saying that they're not great people. They could be honest, great people. But if they are not skilled with money, I mean, if they are not living a life that you desire on that aspect, don't expect them to tell you to do it, because they're not going to know. I mean, even my husband, he's the youngest of six. And I told you his father started doing real estate, but my husband is the only one of his siblings that see value in real estate. None of them. They want nothing to do with the houses. And that saddens me, because I'm like, oh my gosh, this is where like the wealth is, right? But that happens so much because of what they're taught, who you surround yourself with. So it's who you surround yourself with that's going to say like, take the leap or not. Especially in our group, we're doing a soft launch. We just started it. So because of that, I get to consult people, and like they can bring me their houses and I would look at it. I'd look at the numbers. I'd look at the area and be like, if this was me, would I buy it? You know, I can guide them a little bit, no guarantees, but giving them a little bit of push out of the nest. Like if they think it's good and they can cover it, sometimes people just need permission. They just need that reassurance. Like, even if you buy this house and the water heater goes out, what happens? Like, I do the worst case scenario for people, because when you bring it to them, then they're like, oh, well, it's not that bad. Oh, I guess I could recoup that. Like, do you trust yourself to find a solution if there's a problem? And that's a big thing. Mm-hmm. When you said trust in other people, it's really trusting myself. Do I trust myself to follow through with vetting the tenants or vetting the property manager or what, you know, finding a solution if a big money problem comes in? Could I find the money? Could I go to a bank? Could I go to the government and get some sort of whatever, right? So sometimes we just need a push, but you have to surround yourself with the right people that are going to allow you permission and cushion to grow in that.
What are like three things do you think that any entrepreneur going into this should kind of know as like basic basic, like three, I do probably more than three things, but bring it down to like three elements.
So the first one is why, like, why would you want to invest in real estate? Like, I can tell you why, but you have to know why, because nothing is guaranteed. And no matter how all the numbers work out, there's always a little bit of a risk, but the why, if it's big enough, it doesn't matter. You think that we had money when we were 19 and 21? No. You know, like, we just looked at the risk and was like, well, I guess we'll sell the house. I'm sure there's somebody else that'd buy it. I mean, like, we just looked at it like that. So you have to have your why. We wanted to build wealth. We weren't from wealthy families. We wanted to be the wealthy family. So that was our why. Okay. And we went through a lot of hardships with that. So your why is number one. Number two is, again, know your numbers. Like, go on Zillow, go realtor.com, go search the neighborhood, figure out what rent is going for in your area. There's so many resources online. It's so easy. In one night, you could figure out what rent is going for looking at properties. And if there's nothing, like nothing, literally drive the neighborhood. And if you see a for rent sign, call it and ask the landlord, hey, are you ever interested in selling? I would love to buy your property. Like, you got to be audacious a little bit. You know, if you want to do this, if there's nothing in your market space, you kind of have to be a little resourceful, you know? So it's like, so know your vision, know your numbers, be resourceful. Like, those are three, like, if you have those, you'll be golden.
So what's your, like, you know, a lot of people start something and then they can't stick with it. So you got to have the passion, but you also got to be able to like show up and to be able to like if you're the type of person, you start and stop things and then it's like the next fad, like you recommend, you need to have some discipline, right, for this.
Right. And I would say that's why real estate's so good, because it's not a fad, you know, like with Bitcoin and stuff like that. I mean, and I don't know much about Bitcoin, but even like stock markets, there's a lot of different fads and trends and stuff. Like, real estate's pretty test of time. And again, if your why is strong enough, you'll stick and stay. This is why we're the Legacy Wealth Project, because families, your why is your family. That's going to keep you going, and knowing you're building wealth for your families to come. And when you tie that with the element of success principles for kids and family, so that not only are you building it now and going through that, but you're keeping it. So we teach tax strategy. We teach, you know, legacy wealth principles, like what you need to do so that your kids carry on the legacy through real estate, through assets. It's really just through assets, looking at assets, income, things that are making you money. And then even business principles that kids understand and they learn to love, instead of looking at it like, this is taking my mom and dad away. I don't want anything to do with this, because that's how kids feel, because they spell love T-I-M-E. So when you can bring this in and teach them this, they're more likely to follow in your footsteps and be like, carry on that generation of, you know, entrepreneurship, whether that's business, online, bricks and mortar, service provider, whatever, keeping that and then building the assets. So whether that's more houses, maybe that's storage units, maybe that's commercial buildings, maybe that's renting out RVs. Whether, I mean, you, an asset is just something that you utilize to make you money. So it can be a, you know, a food truck. It could be, you know, even your car renting out, like looking at things as assets instead of the liabilities, which are just causing you to spend money. And when you teach kids that at a young age, they look at money differently. They look at it as, you know, give and take, ebbs and flows, seeding and reaping of those seeds. And so when you can instill that into your kids while you're doing it, it is literally a recipe for generational wealth. When you just do it yourself and are like away from the kids all the time, and you're just pouring money and time into these businesses and even like these assets, and they don't see you, that's where the generational gap. And that's why studies show that by second generation, 70% of wealth is gone. By third generation, 90% of wealth is gone. And that is crazy to me, because nobody on here, no entrepreneur, I don't care what your characteristic is, is building a business so that in 30 or 50, 60, 70 years, it's gone. Like, you want it to withstand time.
So the question I have then there is, for your, to keep the legacy going, how much, much of that is working with attorneys and wills and setting up a trust, and how much of it is actually the kind of training you or actually instilling that in your kids rather than the legal mechanisms of the trust and the will and those things, or is it a combination of all of those things?
I mean, I think it's a combo. You have to have a will. You need to like have your things in like line so that when you pass away, because you will, that because that's, I lost my mom. So I know that's such an emotional time for kids, and I don't care what age they are. Like, it's emotional. Like, all my mom's kids were adults and it's still emotional. And she didn't even have a lot of assets, and it still was, okay, what are we going to do with her stuff? Right. So I think that's an important part. And in our group, I bring in experts. I bring in attorneys. I bring in tax strategists. Like I said, you want to make sure that you have your will. And if you have a trust, making sure it's all seamless. And here's the thing too. I couldn't believe this when I started studying this. How many wealthy people, they do a trust for their kids and they don't tell their kids what's in it. And so they go to read the will and it's like a machine gun because nobody knew what was actually going to be given to who. And so you have this emotionally charged moment, which is death. I don't care if you liked your parent or not, let alone if you didn't like them, like if you had ill feelings, and then this will is given, talk about like a machine gun to the family unit. Like, it destroys families. Yeah. And if you are someone who wants to destroy your family,
there should be some communication.
Exactly. And this is what we do. Like, this is what we do. Yes. It's like, you have to communicate, and it's hard. And a lot of driven entrepreneurs have a hard conversation because they've driven such a divide with their kids because they've always done the work thing and they never knew how to communicate or merge the other. That's what this project is. I want to merge that so that the communication isn't hard. When you do a trust, you communicate to the family, this person's getting this, this person's getting this, this is how it's divided. There's no like surprises, because the death itself is usually the surprise. Like, that's enough surprise for the family. So when you go to a will and people already know, it's like, okay, because even honestly, even if you do an estate sale, this happened to my husband's family when his grandma passed, she had an estate sale and the family didn't get the items that they wanted. They had to buy them at the estate sale. And although it didn't cause a big riff, there are still a little hard feelings when you talk about like the dining room table or the lamp over here. Like, it's still a little crazy. So that part of it's good. But what we really dive into is the communication, the characteristics that the wealth building principles, characteristics that kids want to have so they don't have that entitlement. That you teach them work ethic. You don't teach them work harder, because that's a stupid term. Like, it really is. Work is work. You can't work harder. It's the outputs you get from it. But you can gauge work ethic. What's their work ethic? What's their
smarter? You can work smarter.
You can work smarter. But when people say I worked harder, I'm like, harder than who? Because then you're just gauging it. Usually they're referring to physical labor, but that's dumb because my dad was one of the hardest working men I ever knew. And he could barely pay his bills. And that's not a dig on my dad. He did what he thought was right. He thought he was going to get ahead, and he was just given the wrong information. And so many of us do. And kids are taught that. So we unteach that, and we teach them the wealth principles, financial literacy in a way that is receptive to them, and humility, not entitlement. Like, your parents are building this and you will most likely get it, but you're going to be humble about it. We teach them philanthropy, how to give back, how to tithe, what money means, how you can use it as a tool. Those are the things that will create wealth for legacies. Like, yes, the legal part, the will, that's all important. It's important. But the other things, if I could teach two, I would teach the other. I'd teach the characteristics over the legal part of it.
But the question, I guess the point is, like, if you get that trust, but you never had a real good understanding of how much work was done to build that legacy, you never had the conversation that they wanted you to have that legacy, and it's supposed to be like a generational thing for the whole family. If you if you just have that in your mind, right, but you never communicate that to anybody, right, you think it's automatic that they're going to know that. Like, if you don't communicate, like you're saying, and actually get buy-in from the inheritors, right? Like, they have a stake in it. If they realize that they can continue this and it's going to keep on going rather than just use it and go to Vegas, right? It's then there's no consequence. Like, if they don't understand their role, like, it seems like there's a role you need to kind of teach from what you're saying.
Yes. And you tie that in with possible ill feelings to that parent because that parent may have not spent as much time with them. So then you have, I'm mad at my dad because he loved work more than me, which may not be true. But if the child feels that way, I don't care if the child's 2, 20, 40, 60, you know, like, if they feel that, then that money, not only do they have no responsibility for that money, but they almost want to spend it because they think that money is tied to the negative. You know, they want to get rid of it subconsciously. They want to get rid of it as fast as they can because that money is what kept them from what they wanted, which is time. My grandma was wealthy because she had some investments and she had some, she was a two widower, loved the woman, but you know, her husband's just kept having heart attacks and they, but they set her up very well financially. And she always kept saying, I want to do a family trip with all, like, she had three kids with grandkids. We're like, yeah, like, we love trips. This is awesome. Yeah. And my two uncles didn't like to travel. So because of that, we never did it. And I kept telling my grandma, like, and then she kind of say, oh, well, everything's so expensive and cruises are so expensive. And I finally said, Grandma, we'll pay for ourselves. Like, I just want to go on this trip with you because I want the experience with you. I don't want your money when you're dead. Like, I mean, that's awesome. You can leave that to us. And if that makes you feel good, but I would rather spend it and have an experience with you right now. Yeah, and most people, because they want that. They want that connection with the person they love. And so when you can teach your kids and have that, then guess what? They respect the money. And they think, oh my gosh, mom and dad worked for this. And we helped them and they sacrificed for this. Like, we're going to treat it with respect. I'm not going to hoard it, but like, we're going to treat it like they did, like a tool. So maybe we'll invest it in businesses or invest it in real estate or invest it in our family. So you can invest it different ways. You can invest it in your family, take trips, you know, buy toys that for the whole family. Like, we just bought a pontoon boat because our whole family gets to ride on it and we get to have these amazing summer experiences. Now,
I have a story to tell.
I'll probably, and I'll probably rent it out to people so I can start using it as an asset, but that's just the business minded in me. But regardless, we invested in this for our family. So there are some liabilities that are worth it, but look at the full investment of it. If I went and bought a Ferrari, that's probably just stupid liability because my kids can't even ride in it, right? So teaching, So looking at things again, and that's what, it's a mindset. It's surrounding yourself with the like-minded people that are going to help each other and build that and build the families that create that generational wealth. And again, it's not just about like making all this money and being greedy. No, it's literally teaching them philanthropy, having them have a cause that they can donate to. Why we create wealth is so that we can give it back. I honestly think it's selfish if you have the skill set and the mind and you live in the United States, but even other countries, and you can create more money and you don't because you think, well, I'm fine. I just want to live comfortably. I don't need all that money. Well, you know what? The person in the third world country that doesn't even have drinking water, that doesn't have the resource, they need the money. So give it to them if you don't want it. But if you can make it and you can release it into the atmosphere and bless other people, you should do that. Like, I that's my personal conviction, but I think too many people hang their hat on it. Like, oh, it's too hard, or oh, it's this, or oh, I don't want to leave my kids. Bring your kids in on it. That's what this group is about, how you can marry the two, how you can create wealth and have family wealth.
I think that's a totally different focus, because a lot of times people think the wealth, now you're sitting there and it's kind of like Orson Welles, you know, Citizen Kane thing. Mm-hmm. And you're just sitting there by yourself at the end and you don't really have anything. So it's like money is the root of all evil and it creates bad, right? So you get this ultimate bad without thinking about, you know, the Bill Gates of the world who gives all this money away, right? You know, he does a lot of philanthropic organizations and pushes a lot of new ideas because like once you have certain types of wealth, you can build structures and build teaching and learn a lot. Like I'm in the IT world and there's a lot of times there's a lot of reinvestment in technology. Like it's not just putting it in the coffer as an asset, but they'll go and spend it on AI development or they'll spend it on future designs, right? So there's a lot of like research and investment and stuff that's for the future and it costs a lot of money, but you make a profit so you can do those things.
Yes.
So like you create profitable businesses so you can do the research and investment in the future. And the same thing you could, like you say, you could invest in the time with your family, which is like, that's something that maybe you don't quantify monetarily, but it's wealth.
Right. But it is, if you think about the fact that you, if you don't do that with your family, you'll lose it. Then you get people looking at it from a numbers game, like, oh, okay. And sometimes you have to give those, you know, especially very driven entrepreneurs, like, hey, shake it. Like, hey, if you want to keep your money and not just light it on fire when you die, then you need to invest in the relationships here and invest in teaching the characteristics to your kids so that your wealth goes on forever and not just like, oh, dad's gone. Yep. See you later. I'm done. Or, you know, living off the trust while they're sitting at the pool, you know, drinking Mai Tais or whatever. And then that kid's impact on the world is squandered as well. So you, if you are someone who wants impact or wealth, like you have to teach those characteristics to your kids. And number one is spending time with them. But number two is spending that efficient time, because wealthy entrepreneurs, 7, 8, 9 figure earners, they value time. So that's, you know, what we do is we condense it. It's like masterminds that are like an hour powerhouse. You know, we do trainings and things like that, but like just being efficient with the time and not just giving them a whole bunch of stuff to say, oh, our program has 120 modules. No, you don't need that many. You need quick, efficient training, education, and maybe consulting, a little community to get you to do the thing. And then you've built these relationships and then you can build, you know, maybe there's a 40 unit apartment building and two of our members want to come in together and buy that together. Awesome. That relationship's right there where normally they wouldn't be able to do that. Or they, you have an IT business and this person's a service provider and bam, you have a new business relationship, you know, and then their kids mastermind together and they're like, ooh, your parents do this too. And then they become, you know, then they mastermind and they build stuff together. And then bam, you have like-minded kids that are actually making an impact on this world instead of the ones that are just squandering their talents or squandering their parents' money.
And that's a very positive way to look at wealth, which I think has been derided. And, you know, it's like, you know, they the greed is good without saying what you can do with the money. And then that seems like, you know, you're like, there's a lot of things where people say, well, I want to stay away from that because I think it's going to make me bad. But rather than understanding like you, how you use it, it's a tool, like any tool we use. You can either use tools that are, can be positive or can be negative. Depends on what your mind frame is. And you're putting people in a state of mind or point of view that's going to give them like tools that allow you to have, you know, this keep the legacy going. And so I want to, we're at the kind of end of the podcast, but like your website, we didn't talk about like people go to keeplegacywealth.com. What did they find there?
So you'll have a link to a free resource. Again, if you're buying your first income property, there's a free resource. I mean, honestly, if you follow that, like, again, you could be in contract by the end of the week if you wanted to. But our group link is on there. And if this is, if this is live or when this releases or whatever, the month of May and through June, we are doing a founder's price, and it will never be this cheap again. It's like, we're trying to just build up the family, get the first 25 families in there just to really get it going. But come into the group and I teach you how to buy your first income property. And then for the first people that come in, about the first 25, we're going to help consult. So we'll do a consulting call. If you have a house that you, you know, are interested in and you need to be pushed out of the nest, we'll consult with you and help you make that decision so that you get the numbers right. Again, there's no guarantee, but I think just having another set of eyes, somebody who's done it, it just helps. I know it does me. So on the site, that's what you find there. And then you can message me. I'm on Instagram, Facebook. I do have a website, tabtherell.com. So that's kind of the best way that you can reach me. And I have a podcast, so you can always comment on our podcast, and we're really good about reaching out.
And your podcast, what's the name of your podcast again?
It's called What Went Wrong? The Untold Stories of Bouncing Back from Failure.
That's on all the platforms?
All the platforms, YouTube, go check it out. We video all of our guests, and they are incredible stories. I mean, if you need a little bit of hope, or if you're someone like me that just loves hearing stories of people, like how they triumph from the ashes, like literally things that happen to people that would take them out of business or take them out of life. I mean, people that have almost committed suicide, addictions, bankruptcies, seven-figure businesses that they just literally walked away from. Like, it's phenomenal. And they're only about 20. I think my longest one is 40 minutes. So they're short and sweet, commute to work or working out on the treadmill or whatever. And you can listen to them. And so, yeah, really interesting, engaging stories.
Well, I want to thank you for being a guest on the Family Electric Coach podcast. It's been great. And we were live on Facebook, Twitch, and YouTube. We will be published by tomorrow on all the major platforms where you can listen to or watch a podcast, and we'll get that to you by a landing page where people can just choose which one they want to go to. But thank you again for being a guest on the Family Electric Ghost podcast.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Have a good night.
You too. Bye-bye.